the temperatures are starting to drop, the leaves are starting to fall, and the creepy crawlies are starting to look for shelter inside our homes. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our October gardening show, we'll discuss how the tricky weather of the past few weeks has been treating our gardens, with our panel of experts ready to answer your questions for the full hour. Joining me to do just that are Hamilton County Extension and OSU entomology educator, Joe Boggs. Welcome back, Joe.
Hey, it's great to be back, Lucy.
Great to have you. Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director, Peter Huttinger. Thanks for being here, Peter.
Glad to do it.
And Civic Garden Center horticulturist, Julie Denowitz. Welcome, Julie.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have questions for them, and we know you have questions for them, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Joe, just in time for Halloween, you're getting reports about a native kissing bug that sounds more like a vampire bug to me. Tell us about that little guy.
That's very interesting, Lucy, because I'm glad you said a native, because we have quite a few kissing bugs in the world, mostly in Central and South America. And so there are several species. And why people take notice of kissing bugs is, first, yes, they do feed on animal blood. And I say that very deliberately, not just people blood, but animal blood. And in Central and South America, and as it turns out, even in the extreme southern United States, they can be carrying a protozoan that does Trypanosoma cruzi in their gut that can lead to a disease called Chagas disease, which is pretty serious. So when people hear kissing bugs, it's not unusual and maybe even appropriate to connect it to that disease, except here in Ohio. And what's different in Ohio is our kissing bug, which has I'm laughing because it has a horrible sounding common name, and it's the official common name for it. It's called the blood-sucking cone nose. And I'll tell you, it sounds like something you'd say to somebody you didn't like very much, right?
Yeah.
just try that on. But it's the scientific name is Triatoma sanguisoga. And the sanguisoga literally means, it's Latin for a blood-sucking. But the big difference here is that our kissing bug goes after the blood of small animals. So they'll feed on mice, they'll feed even on raccoons and so forth. And where we find them coming into homes is our homes, and this is something I've been keeping track of for several years, getting reports of these. The homes are almost always located in woods or near an area that we'd call naturalized area that's not mowed, and where, of course, we might find a high concentration of small animals, wild animals that the kissing bug can make a living on. They will, though, occasionally come into homes, and what they look like, they're big insects, and they belong to a group of insects called assassin bugs, which have kind of stilt-like legs. They're big insects. They're kind of creepy-looking, pretty good Halloween decorations, too, because the kissing bug, the blood-sucking cone-nose kissing bug, is mostly black, but it has orange or reddish-orange markings. It just sounds like a Halloween motif, doesn't it?
It really does.
Perfect coloration. But so, the important point – oh, go ahead.
Oh, no. Go ahead, Joe.
No. Well, the important point, though, is, first of all, you know, we don't have Chagas endemic. We don't have people who are infected with Chagas living here in Ohio. In fact, there's been no reported cases unless the person traveled, you know, from Central America or South America. So they actually contracted it there, and then they were diagnosed here. So we have no evidence that there's any reservoir for the protozoan. So that means that our kissing bug really doesn't have any place to pick this up. The second thing is just to remember, they're not like bed bugs that just feed on people. And as a matter of fact, and I need to be real careful how I say this because I don't want people to apply this to our native bug, but in South and Central America, some species of kissing bugs actually do behave a lot like bed bugs. They very deliberately come in homes, and they very deliberately target us. And by the way, the name kissing comes from the fact that they feed near our mouths.
Oh, Joe.
Yeah, I know.
So nasty.
I know. It gets worse.
Yeah.
They don't inject the protozoan. They actually defecate. And then people, I know.
Joe.
It's lunchtime. I'm trying to do my best.
My God.
Okay. Don't you have the mute button there?
Well, and I know you're always defending our native bugs. You are a lover of the bugs. But another bug that has pet owners concerned is this Asian longhorn tick, another bloodsucker. There was a confirmed sighting in Butler County. Talk about why that's got people worried.
Well, and I'll tell you, I'm not a tick expert, but it's why I will tell you that even though I grew up in a state, West Virginia, that we were just used to American dog ticks. And so I grew up with ticks not being an issue. However, things have changed since that time. And so now I actually always, when I'm out in tick territory, I wear treated clothing. And I think that's very important. So the Asian longhorn tick, so far hasn't been linked, as I understand it, to any human diseases, unlike the other ticks. They can produce diseases or vector diseases that can affect pets. So that's one thing that we're very concerned about, obviously. It is another reason, you know, that if your pet is you know, acting in a peculiar way and it has had ticks, that you need to get it to a veterinarian. But as far as what we know about it so far and threats to human, as I said, it's my understanding they haven't been linked to vectoring any of the other diseases that we associate with ticks, but you should never take a risk. And like I said, it's, to my mind, very important, you know, to keep that landscape, trimmed. I mean, that's one reason we mow lawns, for example. Keep the landscape trimmed back from your house. And if you're in tick territory, you know, take precautions. You know, I like the treated clothing because, frankly, the repellent DEET, D-E-E-T, I'm a bit sensitive to, and so are other people, but the treatments work very well.
Okay. Well, Peter, speaking of bloodsuckers, is now a good time to plant garlic? I mean, I wasn't referring to you. I was referring here to garlic. When I think of bloodsuckers, October, I think of vampires.
It is Halloween, and that's true.
Yeah.
You can't wear a bulb of garlic around your neck, I guess. This is the time to start putting in the garlic. And I would say just at the front end of it, you can plant it into the first week in November. I've gotten behind and planted a little later, but this is really a good time. When planting garlic, I think it's really important to clean and prep your beds or your very well, because it's going to be in there for a while. So you want to try and make sure that it's not going to be competing with weeds later. And then also after planting it, we'll usually use a straw mulch or leaf mulch, and it's the perfect time of year to collect leaves. You can chop them up by using your bagging lawnmower, as long as you're laying them out on grass that hasn't gone to seed, or else just kind of crumple them up and put them on top.
Yeah. Well,
Peter, what about drainage for garlic? And my understanding is that it doesn't do well in wet feet. Is that true or not?
Yeah.
Maybe I have that wrong.
Well, I mean, most plants really don't do well in heavy clay soil. There's some differences, but you know, you do want to have loamy soil as much as possible. Work some compost into the soil when you're planting it. For one thing, if you think about it, you're planting it around 3 to 4 inches deep from its top. And so you're going to need to be able to get it out, like carrots and any other root vegetable. It's good to have well-draining soil and soil that has a good amount of organic matter in it.
It's our October gardening show. We're talking about some creepy stuff, but it's not all going to be creepy. And our experts are here to take your questions for the full hour. Don't wait till the end of the show. Call us now, 513-419-7100, or email talk@wvxu.com. bulbofgarlic.org. Peter, what else is good to plant this time of year?
Well, I mean, there's at the closing end of cover crops. But really at this point, I mean, if you're going to be using low tunnels and things, you might be able to get away with putting in some of the smaller varieties of turnips and beets. But at this point, or some hardy lettuce, but we're kind of at this point prepping for the spring.
Okay. Julie, something that shouldn't be happening this time of year, there's a tree near Paycor Stadium that's blooming like it's spring. What's going on there?
Right. You'll see sometimes these flowering trees blooming this time of year, and you think, hey, you're supposed to come up in the spring. But really what those plants are doing is they've gotten their seasons mixed up. Plants have a really good way of adapting to the droughts. So it's been really, really dry this summer and autumn, and same with last year. And when we get a little bit of rain or a little bit of cool weather, they say, hey, can I come back to life? You know, I've been dormant. I thought maybe we were done for the year, but now I'm getting a little nice weather. You want to come out. So when you see those flowers, it's not really harming your tree. It's just the plant getting a little confused. And you will see that on a variety of flowering plants, pear trees, crabapple trees, even maybe like a lilac bush or something. It's not hurting your plants. It might reduce your flowering for next year. Mm. I have a forsythia at the garden right now that's blooming, another spring flower, but it got cold and then it got warm and the forsythia said, spring? It's spring now? I bloom? So what we'll see is we'll just see less flowers on it next spring, but the plant is totally fine and it'll bounce right back.
Well, speaking of lilacs, we got an email from Megan who writes, I have a lilac bush in my yard that currently has new leaves budding on it. Is this normal or a sign of distress? It was planted about 4 years ago. It's also getting quite tall and I want to trim it. What's the best time of year to do that? What do you think, Julie?
Yeah, those buds that she's seeing right now, it's the same situation where that lilac is just a little confused because it was going dormant. Now it's coming back out of that dormancy. It should be fine. Your only concern would be if there were a frost, a really hard frost that could damage those leaves and buds. But I don't think we have any frosts in the forecast anytime soon. So she'll just probably see a few less flowers next year. And as far as pruning a lilac, the best time to do it is going to be right after it's done flowering. Because our lilacs bloom on what's called old wood. So they grew this year, they set their flower buds, they're going to hang out all winter, and in the spring or the summer, those flowers that they made this year will bloom. Hmm. So that means if you cut them too soon, you're cutting all those those flowers off.
Okay.
So they bloom on old wood, you want to wait until after they're done flowering to cut them.
Okay, great. Well, we have some callers on the line. Let's start with Janet. Hey, Janet, thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
I have swamp milkweed and plants I planted just this year. Ended up with little tiny yellow bugs on the underside of the leaves. And it has killed the leaves, obviously. And then the stems have gotten turned brown. And they are covered from ground all the way up, and it's just, they're just dying.
Hmm. Okay.
And I don't know what the heck these tiny, and I have some, they're in two different areas, the milkweed and some, the ones further away, have nothing on them. But these I planted just this year, they're all covered with it.
Yuck. Well, let's see what Joe thinks. Joe, what do you think about Janet's milkweed bugs?
Well, I think that they're probably oleander aphids. And that's, you know, we tend to forget that that our native milkweeds and other milkweeds, there are a large number of insects that actually, other than what we would like to have, you know, the monarch caterpillars, but there are a large number of insects that make a living on milkweeds that will compete with the monarchs. But oleander aphid is a non-native, as its name implies. They can build large populations, but of course, there's not a lot we can do about them because you would risk, doing something bad to to what you want to have on there, which includes monarchs, and I have to say, even other native insects that use milkweed as a food source. So, you know, obviously insecticides are out. Even if we use insecticidal soap, this is something that that we like people to use, the insecticidal soaps, but you can even kill small monarch caterpillars with soap. So you got to be careful with that. The best thing to do is first catch them earlier so they aren't building the populations rapidly, and a coarse stream of water to just blast them off will help. It's not perfect. You know, they'll find their way back, but you know, the what I call the water slide of doom can work fairly well for this for quite some time. And if you keep doing it, it will kind of keep the populations from building quickly. And also over time, if they are out there, you'll find there'll be a lot of enemies that will show up, such as, you know, many of our different lady beetles. And of course, some of the other like lace wings and so on and so forth. So that's what I think it is. And Peter and Julie, if you agree with that, you know, then I think that's what this is going on.
Yeah, I'd definitely say oleander aphids, Janet. And can I just say, I'm actually a huge lover of aphids.
Oh my gosh, another bug fantastic. Lover on the show today. Okay.
I really am. And it's because they're doing something so amazing. You know, they're really the basis of that insect food chain. Aphids have this magical ability to turn sap into protein, and they feed so many other organisms in our garden. So I have never seen oleander aphids cause real lasting damage to a milkweed or any other plant they've been on. I know they're a little gross. There's so many of them, but they're really a fascinating little life form. And if you just use the wait and see approach, you'll see lady beetles, their ferocious looking larvae. You'll see those other predators coming to visit them.
She's gone to the dark side, Lucy. I love it. This is Halloween.
There
this is
go.
Halloween, right?
That's right. And they are bright orange, so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Janet, does that help? Have you developed new love for those aphids? I thought we could hear Janet. Hey, Janet, sorry. I thought I had you back. Does that help? Does that help at all? Do you have a new love for the aphids? And maybe I lost you completely. Sorry, Janet. Thanks so much for calling. I sure do hope that helps. Thanks so much. Now we have Kathy on the line. Hi, Kathy. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi. First off, I just want to say I love the public service aspects of this gardening show, and I'm going to be freaked out about those kissing bugs. I'm calling about the spotted lanternfly. I'm just confused about what to do because the state and the county has kind of left us on our own, and they're so fast, they're really hard to kill. And those eggs are so high up, and I'm seeing some damage on some trees and bushes, and I don't know if it's related to them. So would love some strategies on how to effectively manage this issue.
Thank you, Kathy, because I think this is one bug that Joe Boggs says kill it. Am I right, Joe?
Well, yes, but here, yeah, I have no love for these. They're non-native. They show up in huge numbers. They will be huge nuisance pests. They feed exactly like giant aphids. That's interesting, Julie, you said that. Because
I don't love them, though.
No. So they pull out a lot of sap from the phloem, and they pull so much out, so much sugar water, they have to get rid of it in the form of this sticky liquid called honeydew, which is really a nice name for aphid poo. Isn't that right, Julie? I mean, it's just, you know, it's they're voiding it out the back end. It can be raining down, making everything sticky, and then it gets colonized by black sooty mold. So those are all the bad things. Now, in terms of impact on plants, because they do feed like giant aphids, we have to be mindful that, and I need to say this very quickly, we know that their primary host is Tree of Heaven. They're always going to go there first. But very high on the list are our maples. They love red maple, for example. So we do have some concerns about, you know, newly planted red maples in a stressful situation. They could have an impact. As far as other trees, though, if you have established trees, no, they're not going to cause harm. I have a feeling that maybe what you're seeing could be caused by other things, Kathy, but you make a very good point in terms of, okay, state and counties and so forth. And I just handled an email about this today. So in Ohio, We want you to report spotted lanternflies to the Ohio Department of Agriculture. And if you just Google ODA or Ohio Department of Agriculture spotted lanternfly, they have a great online reporting site that you send pictures and so forth. Even though we know it's in Hamilton County, the numbers are trending upwards. By you reporting, we can get some sense of the density of the populations. Now, if you're in Kentucky, and this is very important, it's not Kentucky Department of Agriculture. You would report it to your local extension office. So in Ohio, you don't report it to us. You report it to ODA. In Kentucky, you report it to your extension office. If you're in Indiana, you report it to the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. So Indiana Department of Natural Resources, not extension and not their Department of Agriculture. And that's created quite a bit of confusion. We want people to report it, but we want to make sure that we're not losing time on it. We want to make sure people understand exactly where. And we're in a tri-state area with three states that do things differently. Mm-hmm. As far as what can be done about them, unfortunately, they're not scheduled to be eradicated, unlike Asian longhorn beetle. So, yes, we are kind of on our own, and you can choose to do what you want. I will tell you, though, that eventually next year will probably be even worse than this year. I hate to say that, Lucy, but, yeah, that's been the trend.
Yeah. So you just got to squish them as much as you can. Is that the idea, Joe?
And flee and okay. run away.
Squish
Maybe
and
the
run.
Monty Python. Yes.
Squish and run. Okay.
You know,
I'm sorry. We're going to have to take a quick break. I apologize for cutting you off, Julie, but we're going to continue our gardening show after a short break. Now's a good time to call with your questions. The number is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our October gardening show. My guests are Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, Civic Garden Center Horticulturalist, got that wrong, Horticulturalist Julie Denowitz, and Hamilton County Extension and OSU Entomology Educator Joe Boggs. They're ready to answer your questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Now, before the break, we heard from Kathy about spotted lanternfly. Julie, you mentioned you might have some other advice for Kathy.
I would say the best defense is a good offense. And like Joe said, the spotted lanternfly has a relationship with Tree of Heaven, which is another invasive species here in our area. So if you have Tree of Heaven on your property, it is time to take it down. They're not beneficial trees. The only insect that likes them is the spotted lanternfly. And if you remove a Tree of Heaven from your landscape, you could replace it with something native that's going to support some of the bugs we do like to have around.
There you go. Okay.
Great.
Well, we got an email from Ginger asking, or actually she called but didn't hold, to ask another bug question. She sees praying mantis egg sacs all the time, and she recently saw one break open. The babies started eating each other. This is a perfect Halloween question. Is this a common occurrence? First of all, Peter, do you see praying mantis egg sacs and think that's good news?
Well, for a vegetable garden, definitely, because they, it's a predator.
Uh-huh, okay.
I've never broken open a casing and watched them eat each other. That's new to me. If you garden with children, it's fascinating to see the little babies because they are pretty much proportional to the adults. So they're, it's kind of a fun insect for, families and stuff like that.
Okay.
But Joe, I'm sure, can address the specifics of the cannibalism.
yes, Joe.
Well, it makes them both, it's a two-edged sword with mantids because you're right. They do eat each other. They're very territorial. The other downside is they will eat everything. They'll go after, the beneficial insects as well as those that, that we would hope that they go after the pests. So it's kind of a wash. Although I have to admit, I love to watch them. I'll tell you, it's really fascinating when you watch them track their prey and strike. They move at a a speed that our eyes can't even process. But and that's been studied in labs where when they strike, it's so quick. It's just there aren't even many snakes that can do it. So, boy, I'll tell you, we really are on a Halloween roll, aren't we? We're talking snakes and well, spiders. We got to talk about spiders next.
Oh, let's not. I have a very
zombie insects.
Guy that can turn other insects into zombies. We won't get into that either.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yes, I love it.
Okay. Well, we have a very wholesome question from Joe. Joe asks, "My giant banana plant had 4 babies. I'm a proud granddad, but don't know what to do with the babies this winter. Do you have thoughts about that?"
I think you could treat them the same way you treat your big banana. If you're your mama banana, if you are digging that up to overwinter the root ball inside in your garage or something, add the babies to the party. If you are overwintering it outside with maybe a thick layer of mulch to insulate, you can do the same thing. This is a good time of year to move stuff around in the garden as well, as our plants are going dormant. They take well to transplanting. Temperatures are a little cooler. Ground should be a little moister. Those are yours to enjoy in the same way as the big one. They don't need any special consideration. Just make sure you protect them from that hard frost.
Congratulations, Joe, on being a proud granddad. Peter, what else should we be doing to prepare our home gardens for winter? We were just talking about these banana plants and how to get them ready to...
Yeah, well, with the vegetable gardening, I mean, at one point now, I mean, many people still have peppers and tomatoes, and you have cabbages and other crops in the ground. So you want to use low tunnels or row cover and things like that to protect them if the heavy frost come through. But then the biggest thing is, particularly with your tomatoes and peppers, is as they stop producing, like right now, if you only have flowers on them and that's it, you might as well pull them out and prepare the bed for next year, because it's just not going to have time for anything to happen. And so when you do that, I mean, some people like to leave the roots in the ground, but with tomatoes, because there can be fungal issues, I really don't like to do that. So I remove those. If they have been diseased, I recommend not composting them. Put them in your yard waste bags and put them out and send them off to the wherever that they take it. Yeah. That big compost pile in the sky someplace. Yeah. And so that's it. And also when clearing, I mean, there's some other tricks, like as you're harvesting your cabbages, some people like to leave the roots in the ground, but that could be a little problematic because flea beetle will want to overwinter with their eggs in the roots. Joe can maybe talk about that in more detail if necessary. But so those are the things to think with. Anything like beans, I always cut them off of the ground and leave the roots in the ground. And the other thing is to do a thorough weeding. If you haven't already put in cover crop, there's a few you can consider. But more importantly right now, my emphasis for the home garden, particularly if you have a raised wooden bed or a galvanized metal bed, to use a good mulching on top of. And you can use clear, clean straw, or I mentioned before, the leaves, garden leaves.
Okay. Well, we got an email from Sumac, who writes, "I'm an apartment dweller and I help tend to the flower beds in front of our building in Clifton, not because I'm a glutton for punishment, but because I really do miss getting dirt under my fingernails and watching things grow. One of the trees in front of our building got surrounded this summer by honeysuckle bushes. What's a safe way to eliminate honeysuckle without chopping it down and then dousing it with harmful chemicals? The tree that stays attracts hummingbirds and I don't want to harm it in the process of eradicating the honeysuckle." Do you have thoughts about that, Julie?
Yeah, I do. There's a couple different things you can do to deal with honeysuckle. One is make peace with it in spaces that you just can't eliminate it from. But this sounds like a space that you do want to get rid of it. So we're going to give it a fighting chance. You can dig out the roots and just taking a sharp spade and getting in there and pulling all those roots out, especially when the ground is a little bit softer, maybe after a rainstorm. They usually are pretty shallow rooted, so you can get them out. Another thing you can do is cut it down, but understand that it's like a hydra from a Greek myth. You cut it down and 100 more heads will sprout pretty much forever. As long as that honeysuckle is able to make a leaf or two, it can photosynthesize, it can store up more nutrients and more energy in those roots. You can cut that branch down, another one's going to grow. That's where that poison comes in. And I don't advocate the use of indiscriminate herbicides, but for targeted applications like honeysuckle, sometimes they can be a really good tool in our tool belt. So you could cut it down forever and ever, or you could cut it down once and paint that stump immediately after cutting with a little bit of a glyphosate concentrate. And that one treatment is going to go down into those roots, and it's going to disrupt the plant's ability to draw in more water. It's going to disrupt its ability to make those nutrients, and that's going to kill it permanently. So it's not spraying it all over. It's not getting in contact with any of those flowers or that beautiful tree that you love. It's just a one-time shot of something to really get the job done. But again, persistence pays off if you want to do it that way as well.
Okay. Well, again, it's our October gardening show. If you have questions for our expert, now our experts, now's the time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We got an email from Karen. This is along the lines of these blooming plants this time of year. My iris are blooming. How is this possible? Will it be detrimental to blooming next year? Do I need to take any special precautions? We'll go back to you on this, Julie.
Yeah, Karen, it could be detrimental to them next year, not in the harm of the plant itself, but just in your enjoyment of it. You might not have as many flowers. It's the same situation. Your iris probably went dormant in August or September when we had no rain for a very, very long time. Now that we've gotten a few showers, it's cooled off a little bit. Your iris says, hey, it's safe to grow again. So I would recommend just enjoying it while you have it. Wait until it's done blooming and those leaves have died back to cut it down so that you can make sure that plant has the opportunity to absorb as much energy as it can before winter. And hopefully you still get a few flowers in the spring.
Do you think we're going to be seeing more of this kind of stuff as we see changes in our temperatures?
I do. Yeah. As the climate changes, I think things are going to keep getting kind of topsy-turvy. A lot of the rules that we used to follow in gardening are sort of out the window. We just have to kind of keep up and adapt as things change. I think we can find a way to still have beautiful gardens, but we have to be flexible.
Is that true for vegetable gardens too, Peter?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Well, we are going to take another quick break. We will be back after that to wrap up our gardening show. If you have questions, delay no longer. Call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the home stretch of this month's gardening show. My guests are Civic Garden Center horticulturalist Julie Denowitz, Hamilton County Extension and OSU entomology educator Joe Boggs, and Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger. You can ask them questions or offer up your comments by calling 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Clarence. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I've got Boston ferns that did wonderful this year, first time ever, and I hate to lose them over the winter, but everything I've researched says that you bring them in, they're going to die. I've got a basement. It's not misty. It's not humid, but I can spray them if I think they're going to live. What do you think I can do with them?
Great question. And congratulations on your great ferns this year. Do you have thoughts on that, Julie?
Oh, Clarence, you can try. You can certainly try, but I can't make any promises. They do need a lot of humidity and a lot of regular watering. And one of the problems is by this point in the year, your ferns have been growing so well all year long. Probably that pot that they're living in is more root than anything else. So it can be really hard to keep them hydrated when you have that many roots in the pot. So you can certainly take them to your basement, get a little humidifier on them, spray them regularly, but don't be surprised if you end up with a floor covered in little fern leaves. Unfortunately, they're just one of those things that doesn't always love that transition. Not saying it can't be done. It's just not something that I've had a lot of success with.
Well, Clarence, we hope you have all the luck in the world with those ferns. Best of luck, and thanks for listening. We now have Richard. Hey, Richard, thanks for calling.
Hey, I have a question. I have elephant ears, about 20 of them. This is my first year. So they were telling me I should take the bulbs out and let dry them out and then put them back in next year. So my question is, should I cut them all the way close to the ground or leave a little leaf on it when I dig the bulb out?
That's a great question. Yeah, you're probably going to want to cut all of the leaf off. Leaves are not going to be super useful to your plant while it's in hibernation, is what you can think of. You're just going to want that root ball. So you're going to cut it basically right at the crown, which is where the plant emerges from the ground. It's that kind of like merging between the stem and the root. You're going to cut it right at the crown. And then you can dry them out in your garage or in a cool basement. You want a space that's not super duper cold, but isn't really warm enough to bring them out of dormancy. They're just going to hang out, maybe wrapped in newspaper or something, until we get past the frost date next spring.
Thanks for calling, Richard. I sure hope that helps. We have our experts here to answer your questions. You can ask them anything you want. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Okay, Greg has a question. He emailed, "I was just looking at my iris patch and found that the bulbs have been decimated by iris borers. Is there anything I can do to try to save some of these irises?" I'm going to throw that to you, Joe, because that sounds very bug-related.
Wow, that is a continual issue. I don't think you can grow iris without the risk of the borers showing up. They're very difficult to manage. Julie, I want to tap into you on this because, you know, one option would be, the insecticide approach. But, there again, it's the timing is so critical. And I know people that are, knee deep in irises that still fail with the timing. So, what are your thoughts about it, Julie?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of experience with the iris borer. Knock on wood, mine have been unbored thus far.
They're not.
But certainly when you are talking carefully timed insecticide treatments, that is something that people will do, and maybe they'll miss the mark a little bit, and then they'll come back next year and say, well, it didn't work. So one option is always just to let it play out and see how nature handles the situation. And if we have to take a year off of irises, that could be an option. But I know that's not really what you want to hear.
Yeah. Would be digging them out, removing the infected parts, and then replanting. Is that an option, or are they going to be in the soil?
You might want to put them in a different spot. Joe, do they spend time in the soil at all? Do you know?
No, they're mostly associated with the plant, but even that, I mean, I just have to say that Julie, you're very lucky to be. I mean, I've actually in the past, before I really appreciated insects, dealt with this, and I can say it really can become a losing battle. Now, I want to stress something though, because I love irises. They're an old plant. They're just really showy. So I wouldn't use this and say, well, take that off the list. As you've pointed out, Julie, it's very hit or miss. But once they do target an area, then, as I said, it's kind of hard to deal with them successfully. And, there are a lot of different things. Digging out and inspecting the rhizomes, inspecting, what you're seeing there, and then discarding, because it's not just iris borer, but you can get some decays that occur. And then replanting can be an option, but it's a hard insect to manage.
Maybe just a different spot in the yard then, like you suggested, Steve.
Yeah.
Peter, sorry.
Well, best of luck with those irises, Greg. We hope that helps you. We have Bruno on the line. Hi, Bruno. What's your question?
I got two things. One thing was you were talking about getting rid of honeysuckle. And I would also recommend that after you, cut the honeysuckle and then put some glyphosate on it, to put a baggie over top of the stump and wrap a rubber band around it. And it just keeps it from drying out. And I think it works good. That's one thing. The other thing was on tulips. I got a bunch of tulip bulbs this spring, dug them up. So somebody gave me a bunch of them and I dried them out. And now I don't know, should I wait to plant those in the spring, or should I plant them in the winter so that they can be in the ground and be cold over the winter? Should I plant them now, in other words?
First of all, that is such a cool tip on the honeysuckle. I've never heard that before, so thank you so much for suggesting that. But as far as your tulips, yeah, this is a great time of year to plant bulbs. They kind of like that cold period. It's called a stratification period when you're talking about seeds. I don't know if we use that word when we're talking about bulbs, but the point is that they need that period of cold weather to kind of kickstart their next year's growth. So putting them in now and then keep the squirrels off them as best you can. I recommend maybe some chicken wire over the site to keep them from digging. You should have tulips next spring.
Good luck, Bruno. Hope your yard's beautiful next spring. We now have Amir on the phone. Hi, Amir. What's your question?
Hey, I have a couple of bold patches in my lawn in the grass that I hoped would kind of just fill in over the summer, but I think it was too dry. My question is if it's too late to try and seed those now, or if there's anything I could do to prep myself for next spring to help fill in those patches.
What do you think, Joe?
That's a million-dollar question right now, because we are still, you know, suffering through a drought, and we had one last year. Now, one thing we can take solace in is we look at what happened last year. Keep in mind, our cool season grasses do have the capability, as long as the growing point, the crown, does not dehydrate. They can look like they're dead, but here's a little tip. If the grass, if the grass is sort of a straw color, if it's got, you know, brown to it, light brown, tan, straw colored is the best description, it's still alive. Now, you may want to consider, I'm going to do this evening, for example, even though they're predicting rain this weekend, I'm going to just put a little water down this evening. And a person listening would say, well, you never recommend evening watering. Well, in this case, I'm only watering to keep the crowns hydrated. And that way you don't have to do anything. You might be very surprised at what looks like is dead is actually just drought dormant. They have that capacity. On the other hand, if the grass is gray, that it's a very distinct coloration, it's a gray, very, you know, it's to white, then you want to pull up some of those crowns. That's going to be a little green spot right in the center of the plant. And if you find that it's all dehydrated, it'll look very dark brown, maybe even mushy. I know that's a technical term there, Lucy. I'm sorry to use that. Then you're in trouble. If you did seed this year, there's a probability that you can bring things back. But of course, those seedlings might be damaged by the winter. So we're shifting a little bit this year and saying that, well, you might want to think early in the spring, early March, for example, not early March, but in March at some point. You know, when we're outside the time when we might have a killing frost or freeze, I should say, then go ahead and seed in the spring. Just get prepared, be ready to seed in the spring. Keep those seedlings watered until they get mature. And that's a trick right there, because you've got about a 50-50 chance, about a 50% chance of success if you seed now because of possible winter loss.
Okay. Well, thank you, Amir. Best of luck with your lawn there. And we have Maureen on the phone. Hey, Maureen.
Hi, I'm calling because I have a question that about a month ago, one of your panelists had talked about shocking a plant. And so I didn't get in on what that meant. And I was wondering if he was talking about cutting back the plant, because I'm referring to dahlias. I could not get my dahlias to bloom all summer. They bloomed in the spring a little bit. This all summer, they were just like dormant. So I kept thinking, maybe if I cut them back and cut them back. And I tried it. They got a little powdery mildew, but then I just kept cutting that off. And now they're going like gangbusters. Is that a normal pattern? This is my first year with dahlias. That's my question.
Okay. Julie, your thoughts?
Well, we have a lot of dahlias blooming right now. So my first wonder is, are they just a little late this year? Because our dahlias are looking lovely and they were pretty much dormant all summer. That could, again, have something to do with the drought. You know, when it's really dry out and really hot, plants are just not going to put that energy into flowering until conditions are a little better. But as far as what it means to shock a plant, I think about a house plant and how some of them only flower if they're a little stressed out. It's kind of a defense mechanism where they're thinking, oh my God, my time on this earth is short and I better make some flowers and set some seeds before it's the end. So do dahlias operate that way? I can't say for sure, but it's definitely a possibility.
Okay. Well,
you know, I have to tell you, shocking a plant. I keep thinking, well, Julie and I and Peter would just jump out from behind the shrubbery.
Yeah, that was my first thought, too.
Yeah, you did, too. I knew you all were thinking that. I had to say it.
Or use a taser on it.
Oh, no. Oh, my gosh. Well, thanks, Maureen. Thanks for that call and that terrific question. We've got one more question we're going to try to get to. Rebecca asks, I've got 4-year-old fuchsias that I've cut back and stored in my garage over the years, but this year they started to leaf out in January. They didn't start flowering until the end of August. Even then, it was very sparse. Can they be saved another year, or are they at the end of their lives?
I don't see why not. You've got nothing to lose.
Okay. What do you think, Joe? You agree with Julie there?
I got to go. Julie, I thought you were going to say this because I love what you said earlier about, you know, being root bound. You know, fuchsias actually can take that a little better, as I understand it. But, you know, you may want to look at the pot, too, because if they're just, you know, nothing but roots, then that plant could start declining. You agree with that, Julie, thinking maybe that could be a challenge?
I do. It might be after 4 years. You are probably right, Joe. It might be time to repot those. And then if you haven't given them some flower fertilizer in a while, a little dose of something with high phosphorus fertilizer next spring could help, too.
Okay. Well, Peter, I want to talk to you about something. I'm not going to call you a bloodsucker again, okay. But it's getting to be that time where a lot of people are carving pumpkins, trying to figure out what they want to do with those pumpkin seeds. You have any tips? What's your favorite thing to do with your pumpkin seeds?
But the pumpkin seeds, you can clean them and roast them. I mean, that's the most common thing. Outside of that, I mean, a lot of pumpkins are hybrids. So you don't want to save the seeds to replant them. This could be problematic if they're not heirloom. But really, you know, cleaning it, doing that, I mean, it's fine to compost them. You may end up with some volunteers in the spring, depending on your composting system. But really, it's just to clean. There's lots of recipes for them, and we usually clean them really well, put a little salt on them, spread them out on a tray or in a large cast iron skillet, and do that. And you can also, you know, just also kind of lightly toast them in a cast iron skillet on top of the stove.
And do you like to eat them with the shells on? I understand that's very controversial.
Well, you know, there's, you know, pumpkin seeds that you get, you know, the little green ones. I mean, that's a specific variety. The other ones are bigger. I just chew the heck out of them and do that. But you certainly can. I mean, I'm not a big eater of sunflower seeds if they're hulled. You know, it's more work than I care to go to. I don't sit in a baseball dugout. Chew them and spit them out. But it's more of a fun thing to do as a family. It's not about, you know, surviving the winter on them.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I have been talking with Hamilton County Extension and OSU entomology educator Joe Boggs, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, and Civic Garden Center horticulturalist Julie Denowitz. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.